We're hanging 10 today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The waves in Santa Monica, California are the perfect training ground for Haju Sambe. She's a 23-year-old surfer from Senegal, hoping to make it to the Olympics next year.
Yeah, this is my first time coming here in America, and I'm so happy coming here surfing because you're going to see different people, different wave.
Her coach is Rhonda Harper. She founded an organization called Black Girl Surf to get more women of color into the sport.
Not seeing people that look like me, I decided to just create something for us.
We'll hear their story from California. Plus, have you heard of a Swedish trend called plogging? It combines jogging and picking up litter, and it's spreading throughout the globe. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. A nearly month-long government shutdown, a back-and-forth feud with Nancy Pelosi, not to mention a lawyer who might drop the dime on his old boss. With all of that swirling in the background, President Trump found time today to meet with a spymaster for North Korea. Kim Jong-chol is his name, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's right-hand man. At the end of today's meeting, the White House said Trump will meet the North Korean leader himself again at the end of February. Isaac Stonefish is a columnist at The Washington Post.
As far as we know, the two sides will likely meet in Vietnam. It hasn't been confirmed yet, but Vietnam seems like a safe, also communist country that is economically opened up and is much more integrated with the world than the isolated North Korea is.
We also found out today, Isaac, that Kim Jong-chol might have been carrying a letter from Kim Jong-un to Donald Trump. I mean, we've heard a lot about these letters that the two leaders have exchanged. Some comment from Trump that they've even fallen in love. It does seem all very unorthodox when you remember that the U.S. and North Korea are technically still at war.
The letters, he said it was the letters were the reason that he fell in love. And we do have at least one of those letters public. Trump tweeted it. And Kim Jong-un often refers to him as Your Excellency. And I think that buttering up certainly helps. There's also this really lovely image of Kim Jong-chol's last meeting with Trump, where Trump is grinning and carrying the letter from Kim Jong-un, which is much bigger than a bread box, much bigger than a normal letter. It's sort of an elephant-sized letter. It looks like one of those publisher's clearinghouse
right.
checks.
Yeah, pretty extraordinary. Well, a couple of weeks ago, Trump was at a cabinet meeting, and he said a lot of good things are happening with North Korea. And then he said this.
If another administration came in instead of this administration, namely Mike and myself and the group around this table, you'd be at war right now. You'd be having a nice, big, fat war in Asia. And it wouldn't be pleasant. And instead of that, we're getting along fine. I'm not in any rush. I don't have to rush. All I know is there's no rockets, there's no testing.
Now, this is something, Isaac Stonefish, that Trump has said numerous times, that there'd be war, a big fat war, some kind of war with North Korea if it wasn't for him. How true is that?
It's impossible to prove that a counter-narrative is false. I think it's very, very likely that Trump is wrong on everything he was saying, other than that a big fat war in Asia would be unpleasant. That is certainly true. But I think part of what Trump did was created or really brought an urgency to this crisis with North Korea and then stepped in and is trying to take credit for solving it.
And are they getting along great, North Korea and the States, Trump and Kim?
Trump and Kim are getting along famously. And I do think it's a positive step that North Korea is not testing its weapons. It's not being as outwardly threatening as it used to be. But we still have these really fundamental issues between what the U.S. wants from North Korea and what North Korea wants that don't seem like they're going to be getting solved.
Yeah. So the White House is still talking about denuclearizing North Korea. How's that going since the first Trump-Kim summit last summer in Singapore?
I think it's fair to say that North Korea will almost certainly not denuclearize, and the United States will almost certainly not drop its requirement that North Korea denuclearize. So I think it's in some ways similar to where the U.S. and China are on trade negotiations. I think both sides, I think the U.S. and the North Koreans are going to have another agreement, and both sides are going to claim that this solved the issues that they had. When it actually doesn't, it'll just be a sleight of hand.
Right. So solving kind of a crisis that was already manufactured, I guess. Does that suggest that the love, the kind of counterpoint that Trump is declaring for Kim, is the love also manufactured?
Oof. You know, I really hope not, because in a world like this, it's nice to see two people fall in love.
Really, just throw me any bone, even if it's a rubber bone.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing.
Isaac Stonefish, Global Opinions columnist for The Washington Post. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Day 28 of the government shutdown. There's also a shutdown of sorts in Zimbabwe today, an internet shutdown.
We really were not expecting that government would shut down the internet totally.
Kuda Hove is with media rights organization MISA Zimbabwe. He's in the capital Harare, and he told us the government there shut down the internet in response to deadly protests that broke out over big increases in fuel prices.
What we've had is a partial shutdown. Then we've had a period of a total shutdown. Then we've had a partial shutdown. And then we've had a period of a total shutdown. And we're currently in a phase where there's partial shutdown of the internet. That's why I'm currently using a VPN to connect to my social media apps.
Well, as you say, Kuda, you're using a virtual private network, a VPN, to speak with us right now. But just like for day-to-day life, how disruptive has a shutdown been?
The fact that there's no social media right now for people to share information, people have then opted to just stay at home. Children haven't been attending school. Payments as well have not been going through. You now need to physically go to the bank, and the amount of time it will take the bank to clear your international payment is much, much longer. And there has been a serious rise in the amount of queues at the few supermarkets or food grocery shops that are open in Harare and in Bulawayo. So it's now the norm for people to spend up to an hour and a half at a supermarket just queuing up and trying to stock up on basic commodities.
Wow.
Because there's this tension in the air and people don't really know when life will go back to normal.
Yeah, when will life go back to normal? Like, when is the internet service going to be fully restored? Do you have any sense?
So we've had rumors. We've had rumors that normal service resumes somewhere around Sunday, when government is really sure that there's no more protests and there's no more people spreading malicious, in quotes, messages on social media.
I'm curious, how common is it for Zimbabweans to use VPNs, virtual private networks, as you are?
So it's not that common, but I was speaking to people from Siphon. That's the VPN that we've been recommending to people because it's easy to set up and use. And they say that over the past 2-3 days, they had recorded at least 10,000 downloads.
Wow.
For their VPN. So that shows two things. That shows that people really want to get online, and that shows that at least 10,000 people did not have access to VPNs before this whole thing started.
Kuda, it's kind of crazy. We're barely 3 weeks into 2019, and we've seen several governments in Africa, like Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo, Gabon, now Zimbabwe, finding various reasons to shut down the internet and online services. Are there any similarities?
Definitely, definitely. So whenever governments in Africa, specifically in the examples that you've given, and even in the Zimbabwean example or a Zimbabwean context, whenever a government feels that there is so much information that is being shared among the society or community that might adversely affect that government, then that government will sort of leverage or lean on mobile service providers and internet service providers to switch off access to the internet in a bid to keep people in the dark, in a bid to keep information from flowing.
Kuda Hove with MISA Zimbabwe, a media rights organization in the country, telling us about the internet shutdown there this week. He was speaking to us from Harare on a virtual private network, I might add, that remained, fortunately for us, stable for the last few minutes. Kuda, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me on the program, Michael.
I always thought a great scheme would be a gym where the ellipticals and the treadmills and even the weight machines all capture the energy created during a workout, a kind of two birds with one stone workout. So the fitness trend known as plogging caught my eye. Plogging started in Sweden a few years back with people simply picking up litter while jogging. The word plogga is a mashup of the words jogging and plucka up. which is Swedish, as you might have guessed, for pick up. Plogging has now become a global phenomenon. Ultra runner Ripu Daman is part of the movement. He's been called India's first plogger. He runs the Instagram page Ploggers of India, so this is serious. You're in Mumbai, Ripu. How did you first get into plogging?
Hey, Marco. So I'm a runner. I run marathons and ultras as well. So probably when you're a runner and you run in the mornings when there's lesser traffic and much lesser people, the thing that you observe most is trash and plastic. That's what we saw. And me and my group, we were already cleaning up individually. And later that year, this was 2017, we came across a cool term, plogging, and we thought this is exactly what we do, and it was kind of becoming a global trend. So in order to take our mission forward, we renamed ourselves Ploggers of India. That's a short story.
And that's the story. And as I said, it began, apparently, the trend with ultra marathoners, people for whom 26.2 miles just isn't enough punishment. Was ultra marathoning just kind of too boring for you? You had to do something else while you were doing it?
I mean, runners are crazy. Even when you run 5 kilometers, it's crazy with all the torture that our body goes through. And once you get the high of that torture, there's no stopping. There's no limit to that sky. So we move to marathons and then ultras, 100K, 100 miles, and what all and what not. So marathoners are crazy.
So in India, littering, how big a problem is it there? And is it something that worries a lot of people?
Well, if you talk about India, littering is a major problem. But I've traveled all across the world. Recently, I was backpacking in Europe for a month. And I can tell you that littering is a problem everywhere. With us humans, we will go anywhere in the world and we will leave our marks. So, for example, I was in Northern Ireland recently. It's such a beautiful place, extremely picturesque. There's the beach, there's the mountains right next to each other. And still there was so much of plastic, right? So littering is a problem everywhere, whether it's India or outside. But yes, it's probably a bigger problem in India.
How unique is your perspective, is your kind of eye for seeing trash on the ground, do you think, among marathoners and ultramarathoners?
I'll give you an instance. So I was working full-time. I had a startup, a technology startup, and I was going for a meeting, fully suited up and probably trying to look my best. And the next moment, I realized that I've actually bent down and picked up a plastic wrapper that was there without necessarily intending to pick it up, right? So it's kind of become second nature to me. And that's what my hope or envision for Ploggers of India is, that every person in this country takes responsibility of the plastic and trash around. We don't just clean up. We actually reduce the amount of plastic and trash we are generating by especially cutting down on single-use plastic.
So, Ripu, you are India's first plogger, but you're not doing this alone. Who are some of the ploggers you mostly work with?
Well, we've got ploggers all across India now, and people do take it up very, very enthusiastically. Kids, school children take it up like fish to water. And that's been the biggest high out of all of this, because there are a lot of times when we're doing this activity in our local parks or somewhere, and then some kids see us doing it without asking what you're doing, they just come, join us, and be a part of it, right?
And that's awesome.
And the habits that get inculcated at this young age will last a lifetime. And my hope is, and my belief is, that they will be the leaders of change, guiding us to a better future and environment. And that's the biggest high that I get whenever we are plogging and kids join us.
Yeah, great to hear that. Safe to say you have done your part, likely a lot more than most people. India's first plogger is his claim to fame. Ripu Daman, thanks so much for your time and for keeping things clean.
Thank you very much, Marco. Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The 2020 Summer Olympics in Tokyo are still a year and a half away. It's gonna be gnarly. Yep, the first Summer Games where surfing will be an event. Like athletes in any Olympic sport, surfers are currently doing what it takes to qualify. For one 23-year-old hopeful from Dakar, Senegal, that means spending time catching waves on the beach in Santa Monica, California. Tipa Fernandez has our story.
Santa Monica Beach, early on a winter Sunday morning. The air is crisp. Locals, wrapped in coats, gripping coffee mugs, walk dogs. Kids ride the bike path. Joggers. There's also two black women in wetsuits, stretching.
You're having a hard time with these squats, huh?
Rhonda Harper is their coach, their surfing coach.
You added some, so you got to get down.
She also founded an organization called Black Girls Surf.
Yes, thank you. Yes.
She's chosen this spot at Santa Monica Beach because of its very particular history.
This was formerly known as Inkwell Beach. It was a segregated beach during the Jim Crow era. 200 square foot roped off segregated area for Negroes only.
You guys surfing this morning?
One of only two places blacks could go to the beach in Southern California until the Civil Rights Act of 64 outlawed segregation. And yet, today, Harper and her two surfer students are the only black women on the beach as far as the eye can see.
It's uncomfortable to come because it's so white, but it's comfortable because I know I have a place here.
You tried.
Haju Sambe is doing her pre-surf stretches. She's a 23-year-old surfer from Dakar, Senegal. She started surfing the waves there as a very young girl.
We live in a neighborhood that is near the ocean. My family is full of surfers. My uncle and cousins, I always watched them surfing.
Little Haju joined in.
When you are a kid, you take little broken boards, you swim with them and you find hidden waves, and like that, little by little, I started liking surfing.
But in her Muslim family, girls surfing was frowned upon.
When I started surfing, many people told me to stop. People said this isn't something for girls. But I didn't listen. I continued.
She was pretty good, too. She much preferred surfing to school and dropped out when she was 13. She got a job at a surf camp in Dakar. That's where Rhonda Harper found her. See, Harper, then a surf contest judge, as well as a surfer, was appalled at how few black women she encountered in the waves.
Not seeing people that look like me, I decided to just create something for us.
So, to get more black women surfers on the professional circuit, she held a contest just for black surfers. To find these athletes, she, well, surfed the internet. When she found Sambe and saw her surf, she believed she was looking at Olympic talent and immediately fundraised to bring her to the U.S. to train. Sambe has been in California almost 6 months now.
All right, let's go. Paddle, paddle.
And has trained on waves from Santa Cruz to Venice Beach.
Yeah, this is my first time coming here in America. And I'm so happy coming here surfing because you're going to see different people, different wave.
But Sambe has also had to adjust to being stared at and treated aggressively in the water. It's what one might call surfing while black.
Well, when I was in the water surfing at Santa Cruz, sometimes I get snaked a lot.
Getting snaked is when another surfer cuts in or jumps the queue of surfers waiting for a wave. And it got worse than just snaking.
Like recently, when someone grabbed another surfer's leash, we were surfing in Venice. I thought maybe it was because we are black, but we don't know. In Senegal, that doesn't happen.
A white surfer pulled the cord attaching Sambe's friend's ankle to her board, causing her to spill. The incident happened to be caught on camera by an NBC crew who were out shooting the black women surfers. Jeff Mercado was one of the reporters.
The person who pulled the leash had talked to my colleague, asked what they were shooting. My colleague responded that we were shooting with Black Girl Surf, said some not so endearing things, you know, called them, you know, a joke. And then a few moments later, the leash pull happened. So then once we added everything together, we came to the conclusion that this wasn't done on accident, that he had intent.
Now, the world of surfing is known to be extremely territorial. Surfers don't like other surfers coming to their waves. But Rhonda Harper says what black women surfers experience is beyond localism.
I've never seen someone harassed as much as Haju does in the water. And it's a microaggression. It's the subtle cutting off. I mean, some are just overt. They just will just run you right over.
Surfing has a long history as a very white sport. So there's this cult surfing documentary from the mid-60s, Endless Summer.
Robert August, Mike Hinson.
Where two white American surfers travel the world following the waves. Stop number one, Sambe's home, Dakar, Senegal.
On the plane heading for Africa, Robert wondered what was in store for them. Would they find surf? Would they catch malaria? would they be speared by a native? He didn't have any idea.
Yes, that was 1966, but Harper wonders what has changed.
I like to call localism another form of colonialism. The beaches are being recolonized by white males. The thing about localism that cracks me up is that you truly can't say that you own this beach or this is your area, this is your... That's public property.
Harper says she has to keep an eye on other surfers to make sure they aren't harassing Sambe. But she's also a happy spectator when Sambe rides a wave well.
Let's do it. Ah, yes. That was good.
A young man with a recorder approaches her. He's a student from New York University doing interviews about people's use of social media.
What do you do?
I'm a coach, Olympic coach for surfing.
Oh, nice.
Harper is owning proudly that her goal is to get Sambe to the 2020 Olympics as Senegal's female surfer. It's the first time surfing will be in the Olympics. But even though catching a good wave and beach access to train is free, the biggest hurdle for a talented surfer like Sambe is the money to make it to all the qualifying events around the world.
It is absolutely an elite sport, and there needs to be a change. Like, the average surfer is probably spending anywhere from $50,000, $60,000 a year. You can travel and fees and equipment to travel the world and do these circuits.
So Harper is fundraising through GoFundMe and Facebook, and she hopes to get enough money so that Sambe can compete at upcoming international surf contests where she'll earn the necessary points to be in contention for the Olympics.
Don't worry, coach.
Sambe is out of the water now, and with her surfboard under her arm, she beelines straight for me.
It's so amazing I am here for training for the black girl surf, because I am here for my country, I am here for Africa, I am here for black girl surf, for represent for the black people.
So when you're watching the 2020 Olympics, remember her name, Haju Sambe. She may be one of the only black surfers there. For The World, Deepa Fernandez, Santa Monica, California.
When I was in Dakar a few years back, I could only admire the great waves there, the sets, as surfers call them. Terrific to know that those waves have produced some great surfers like Sambe. We've got some badass shots of Sambe in action in California. Check them out at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Chinese President Xi Jinping is a big fan of Hollywood movies, including The Godfather.
Senators and presidents don't have men killed.
Who's being naive, Kay?
We find out that Xi Jinping has learned a thing or two from the film.
I think he has studied that. From that position, he has understood power.
Quotations from President Xi's unauthorized Little Yellow Book. That's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. New York is my hometown. I was just there 2 weeks ago. And every time I go, the changes are dizzying, especially when I think back to New York in the 1970s and the places that have shut down since then, taking a bit of history with them. Sometimes, though, they're not gone forever. Journalist Michelle Chen found one such story of change and renewal, and it's pretty personal, isn't it?
Yeah, I didn't have to look very far at all for the story. It's the story of the store that my dad founded and my parents have been collectively running for the past, 40 years or so. So it's sort of evolved into a Chinatown institution of sorts, and it's kind of a New York City institution.
Right. So it is your family story and the story kind of New York City and retail and a whole bunch of things. So let's listen to it, and we'll chat when we're done listening.
It's a busy night at my parents' store on Broadway in Soho, New York. I'm following my mom around the sprawling three-story space near closing time.
Do you think most people know it's the final day? They get it?
Most people know, but they aren't.
That's right. We're not just closing for the day. It's spring of 2016. Our lease is ending, and Pearl River Mart is leaving the space for good. And we're not sure if we'll be able to move to a new space. We're not sure if we'll just shut down the business forever. I step through piles of cardboard boxes, dismantled display shelves, heaps of package stuffing, and of course, all of our products. Colorful stacks of kitsch lined up for final clearance. Embroidered slippers, Buddha trinkets, satin pajamas, Ming vases, T-balls, even antique Mao Zedong posters. Some shoppers mill about.
But Pearl Rivermen in particular, I feel like, has always been a place that you can go and find treasures. And, like, you know, this place has been a huge part of so many people's lives. And thank you to your family for making that happen.
Really, yeah, glad to be of service. It's our pleasure. What's your name?
Sarah.
Pearl River Mart, New York's first and only Chinese department store, is going the way of so many other classic city mom and pops. Dive bars, jazz clubs, and movie theaters. We're all turning into the ghosts of a city that's becoming unrecognizable to me, a lifelong New Yorker. One thing that hasn't changed about Pearl River over the last 40 years, it's where people from all over come together and just shop. Here, young and old New Yorkers rub shoulders. People whose tastes in fashion range from business suits to punk leather jackets, where hipsters and union carpenters browse the racks together. This, to me, embodies the cultural mosaic of New York. It's like the subway at rush hour, but no one's in a hurry to leave. Except many of our customers have already moved on over the years. You can say we've all migrated. This store, the store I grew up in, always meant movement. It brought China closer to Chinatown. It brought Chinatown to the rest of America. The store I grew up in is really a store where Chinese America grew up. That's my dad, toasting the employees at a send-off dinner in a local restaurant. My mom reflects back on what Dad's accomplished.
He's the one who dares to find a way, his own way. He always more focused on the longer vision of it.
It's amazing to think of where that vision has taken him from when he first arrived in Chinatown in the 1970s.
I come to Chinatown as like a foreign alien, you know.
Back then, it was a different world. China was still behind the Iron Curtain, and soy sauce and chopsticks were exotic to Americans. There were no real diplomatic or commercial relations with China, but there was a lot of curiosity.
People have a pretty vague about China. They know, oh, China is a big country, you know, long history, you know.
Chinatown was going through its own version of the political unrest of the time. Corky Lee, a local photojournalist, explains.
It was like about 6 years after the relaxation of the immigration laws. Chinese immigrant population became politicized, so that's why you had protests in 1974 for Confucius Plaza. You had a police brutality protest in 1975 down at City Hall.
My dad was in the thick of it, and he soon gained a reputation in Chinatown. The brash young chemist from Taiwan turned Maoist revolutionary. So the store was born under the scrutiny of both the government and a wary Chinatown community. But he was fearless. He wanted to show a different, less forbidding face of China. With funds pooled from a bunch of his grad school and activist friends, Dad opened Pearl River Mart in 1971. It would roughly mirror the stores in China that sold authorized imported goods to diplomats and foreigners. Pearl River would be a U.S. counterpart. One of a few American stores that openly traded with mainland Chinese businesses. Unlike the friendship stores in China, this one would be open to all.
So when we start first day, September 1st, I remember, almost the same day, all the shelves were empty. And we didn't put any advertisement, but it seems the whole city, you know, right away, you know.
The store founded was like nothing the city had ever seen, with a full array of goods Chinese immigrants missed from back home. And of course, Maoist propaganda galore. These products were familiar to many local Chinese, but not to most Lao Fan or foreign barbarians. Then in 1972, Nixon made his groundbreaking diplomatic visit to China.
And let the great Chinese people and the great American people be worthy of the hopes and ideals of the world for peace and justice and progress for all.
The normalization of U.S.-China relations began, and trade restrictions loosened. With my dad importing goods from the Maoist Empire's previously isolated factories and workshops, His little emporium helped grease the skids for his homeland's great awakening. But not all the attention was good. The bitter legacy of the Red Scare was still looming over Chinatown. The feds even suspected my dad was a spy running a communist storefront.
So when I first of all, the FBI called me, you know, to interview some older Chinese friend, you know, they said, oh, don't talk to them, very dangerous.
The FBI would show up regularly at the store.
Two of them, every time, different people probably come here and want to talk to him. They feel there's something behind this. There's hands from China. So they try to find out. But on the other hand, they probably try to intimidate you, you know, say, okay, we are watching you, but we have nothing to hide.
But my dad had a trick. Instead of submitting to interrogations at FBI headquarters, he'd treat the agents to a Chinese restaurant meal. The authorities tried to juice my dad for state secrets, but got a free lunch instead, while my dad got away with taking the fifth. No, Pearl River wasn't a communist front. But the glorious image of China it projected was my dad's socialist utopia. In the late 1980s, my parents took a gamble on moving out of Chinatown to Soho, a fashionable, artsy neighborhood. The first move was to the borderline of Chinatown and Soho. There, we chased an expanding market of American shoppers obsessed with Chinese stuff. We carried the old favorites, like tea and sesame candies, but our shelves now featured bonsai trees and exotic incense for the New Age Buddhists. Teenage girls loved our glittery brocade Cheongsam gowns. In middle school, I even promoted myself to bicultural marketing chief and wrote Pearl River's first English-language mail-order catalog. From there, it was up and up, and even uptown. We moved two more times. Our final location was a big department store. No more Chinatown. We'd crossed the Rubicon to Soho, right across from Bloomingdale's. The move brought us even more publicity. Sarah Jessica Parker raving about us on Oprah. And Queer Eye, the original one, that is.
Another thing that I thought was really great, this is also from Pearl River, are the umbrellas.
Oh, wow.
So this is going to sort of be this beautiful glow.
But our leaving Chinatown didn't just mean the business had grown. It signaled a bleaker trend. Rents downtown were soaring, pricing out much of the local working class. The garment factories and little stores that had supported Chinatown were collapsing, one by one.
I came to Chinatown since 80, right? And at the very beginning, probably a lot of laundry, you know, it's the main thing in Chinatown, and then restaurant, and then the garment workers. After 10 years or so, it's all gone. First they moved to Brooklyn and then to Queens, but then it's all gone. And Chinatown, it suffered without those people's support.
Pearl River's moves reflected that change. We unmoored ourselves from a sinking ship and headed for more promising shores. But leaving Chinatown, where Pearl River was born, cost us, too. By the mid-2000s, we had swelled to a huge three-level business operation. When we first opened, we were a breakthrough in so-called ethnic retail. Our crossover act showed a mom-and-pop shop could ride globalization to the top of the market. Then Soho got more expensive, ironically in part because of businesses like ours. Many ignored the risk that the big retail bubble might go pop one day.
For us, you know, we don't have a strong financial background, you know, at the beginning, you know, and it's, the only thing we have is we like to take risk.
We rode the risk for as long as we could. Eventually, it hit us that New York was outgrowing small businesses like ours, too. With the 2007 recession, retail markets crashed. But the city's rents remained absurdly high. Soon, the revenue from our foot traffic just couldn't keep up with our rent.
It's a challenge, and especially we have such a big space. There's nothing much you can do. You cannot blame the landlord. That's capitalist. I mean, this is a free market, you know.
Wow, that is an epic story, Michelle. And let me just ask you, I mean, right there at the end, I was kind of shocked to hear your mom say that, well, that's the way it goes. That's a free market. Does her husband, your dad, with his leftist views, which I don't know, maybe they've mellowed, but still, does he agree with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, truthfully, do you know any leftists who have been doing it for 40 years and haven't mellowed somewhat?
Right.
Everybody's got to roll with the punches. But, I mean, my parents, they're above all resilient. You can't take business too personally, I guess.
I mean, I was born in New York City and spent some time there growing up. And every time I go back, it's more and more unrecognizable, not just the buildings, but the faces in the streets. So I get change is inevitable. But what do you think has been lost? Because this is kind of the trend all across the country.
Yeah, and I think of what's lost in retail. I mean, really, stores like Pearl River and countless other mom-and-pop shops that went before the big chains did, they were sort of a canary in the coal mine.
So I know, Michelle, that the closure of Pearl River Mart in 2016 is not the end of the story. So what's happened since?
Well, my sister-in-law managed to step in with a sort of last-minute rescue/intervention, and she is now heading up the business in a new form, and it's sort of pared down its old, large retail space, and we're becoming a much sleeker, hipper, more youthful operation. But what's great about it is that it has indeed carried over from one generation to another, quite literally. My parents and my generation, too, we're all kind of in it together. And in a way, we're embarking on new horizons, but we're retaining a lot of the old in the best possible way. And I hope that more businesses and more institutions can sort of find that sweet spot.
What connections does Pearl River Mart today still have to Chinatown, where it all started?
Yeah, well, it's been a while since you've actually been situated in Chinatown. But in a way, we brought Chinatown to the rest of the world. And we like to think that because it was our birthplace, it's kind of followed us wherever we've gone. We're proud to sort of bear that torch. China's so familiar to everyone in America now. It's no longer considered a novelty or exotic per se. But I think Pearl River still has both a nostalgic and a very contemporary role as a cultural ambassador of sorts, especially in times like this. It can still get people to understand this sort of vibrant hybridity that is neither China nor America, but something distinctly Chinese American and, of course, very, very New York City.
How do your parents like the new operation?
I think they like it. They still can't get around to the idea of actually retiring. So they're still in the store basically every day. We were actually afraid when we really thought the store was going to go completely closed that they really wouldn't have anything to do. But thankfully, we found a way to occupy them and work off some of that excess energy. You know, my parents aren't fixated on the old ways. They understand that things will have to change. And, you know, they're rolling with the punches just like the rest of us. That's all we really can do.
Michelle Chen, a New York-based journalist, thank you very much for sharing the story of your family's business. It was great to speak with you again.
Oh, thanks for listening.
Michelle's story, by the way, came to us from Feet in Two Worlds, a project that brings the work of immigrant journalists to public radio and online media. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. You've probably heard the quotations of Mao Zedong and about his little red book. But what about Xi Jinping? Like Mao, Chinese President Xi is eminently quotable. So a Chinese artist and writer living in the Netherlands decided to create a little yellow book of Xi's greatest quotes. We're going to speak with Julie O'Yang in a moment. First, let's hear some of Xi's wisdom. Since our newsroom is in Boston, we thought, you know, we should get someone with a quintessential Boston accent to be the voice of Xi. Absurd? Yeah, maybe. We asked our WGBH News colleague, Peter Katsas, to play the part.
Who on earth doesn't love a good leader? The Chinese nation will become a proud and active member of the global community.
More quotations from Xi Jinping and the voice of a true Bostonian in a moment. Let me first introduce artist Julie O'Yang. Julie's curated this new book of Xi Jinping quotes. It's called The Little Yellow Book, Quotations from Chairman Xi Dada. Julie, thanks for being with us. It's not a little red book. Mao already had taken red. Why yellow?
Yellow because it's a new time, it's a new era. Chairman Xi Dada has said when he received Trump last year in the Forbidden City, he said, "We have yellow skin, we have dark hair, we are descendants of the dragon," which means he thinks yellow is a proud color. That's why.
Xi Dada, Chairman Xi Dada, not Xi Jinping. Why Dada? Explain that part.
somebody on Chinese social media channel tried to market him to brand this new fatherly image. Out of the blue, he said, "Xi Dada, what are you up to now?" So that became very, very popular. And then afterwards, Chinese Communist Party took over that name. And it became more and more popular every day because pop singer-songwriters did a few very popular songs. And it took off.
中国出了个习大大, 多大的老虎也敢打, 天不怕地不怕, 做梦都想见到他.
So if you were to refer to Xi Jinping as Dada in China, that's okay? Nobody would, like, throw you in jail?
No, it's a great name for him. He loves it.
I also think about your own work as an artist. Dada, of course, is that great absurdist artistic movement. Are you a Dadaist?
I used to be.
Now, speaking of Dada,
I want to press the like button for our great Chinese people.
Julie, collectively, all these quotations represent not just Xi Jinping as a leader, but also China, its people and society, it seems. And Xi Jinping is nothing if not a booster for his vision of a perfect China. What was your aim of this book, of pulling together these quotations from Xi Jinping?
Yeah, we started, me and my collaborator, Fernando Eloy, we started talking when Xi Dada took away the term limit in last year. That's when we started to talk about this idea, this crazy idea to make a book about him, because we were joking that he had the ambition to take over the position of Mao Zedong.
Sink our teeth in the hard bone, show our courage and guts to press ahead and take reform forward.
Andy Warhol was curious about China. He famously visited the country in 1982 and said at the time that the way to understand China best is through Mao's Little Red Book. So if you take that quotation we just heard from Xi Jinping about sinking our teeth in the hard bone, what can we learn today from these quotations of Xi Jinping about the new China? I mean, would Warhol say these quotations are just as revealing?
I think he would have said that, because the reason why Andy Warhol appreciated the Little Red Book is that because it's so simple and it's so accessible, and it is it makes you think and you can interpret, you can discuss things. It's a great, great opening. I think that quote is very revealing in the sense that we know Chinese are very hardworking people, and he's pushing forward that image, plus some socialism with Chinese characteristics. That is the heart of his philosophy.
Finally, we learn from one quote that Xi Jinping is a fan of Hollywood, especially World War II movies, and
I have watched Deer Hunter and The French Lieutenant's Woman, starring Meryl Streep, and The Godfather.
My father's no different than any other powerful man. Any man who's responsible for other people. Like a senator or a president.
You know how naive you sound.
Why?
Senators and presidents don't have men killed.
Who's being naive, Kay?
Yeah, Al Pacino and Diane Keaton and The Godfather there. So, Julie,
wow.
Yeah, I know. Is it that moment from the film that made an impression on Xi Jinping, do you think?
I think he has studied that. You have to understand that he belongs to the elite class. From that position, he has understand power.
Yeah, and he has consolidated his power and ended the term limits last year. Should we be worried? I mean, we're hearing, like, who's being naive, Kay? Of course, heads of state kill people.
Well, there's because I'm not inside of the Communist Party. I have left China about more than 20 years ago, and I have remained a close observer. And I think there's a lot of struggles, political struggles going on between different cliques, which has always been the case. So I hope that, you know, the internal struggles will keep things in balance somehow. But I don't know. I'm holding my breath.
Internet can destroy our party and our country.
As a former Dadaist, Julie was compiling this book of Xi's quotations, An Exercise in Absurdity.
Well, as an artist, I see it, of course, it's a kind of gadget object I'm making, I want to make people think. So it's got to be a little bit absurd, because otherwise you can't break through the wall. And you are going to go into the routine of academic work. So, yeah, it's not a common take.
Well, it certainly made me think, and in a really fun way. So, good work.
Thank you very much.
Fight tigers as well as flies.
Peter Katsas, a true Bostonian and senior editor here at WGBH News. Big thanks to him for reading quotations from Chinese leader Xi Jinping. Those quotes and many more can be found in the Little Yellow Book, curated by Julie O. Yang. The Godfather theme on the erhu, that Chinese fiddle. Nice touch, too. Okay, we are out, unlike the Godfather, who keeps getting pulled back in. Our theme was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend, everybody.
PRI, Public Radio International.